The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
And now, Sports Talk 1240.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to Sports Talk 1240 on this Sunday, June 21st, 2015. Happy Father's Day to everybody out there. Gary Harding and John Panarese here for the first hour. And for our first guest will be Charles Learson, writer of the book Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. We're going to get a lot of great insight to a great book that we really feel all you dads, if you didn't get it for Father's Day, go out and definitely get a copy of this book. It's a great read. And in the second half hour, we're going to talk to Lou Ford of the surprisingly white-hot Long Island Ducks, winners of 19 of their last 20 games in a feverish pitch to try to capture the first half of the Atlantic League. And good evening, John, and how are you on this warm Father's Day?
I'm doing well. How
good.
Are you doing?
Excellent, excellent. If you're a Met player right now, you're not doing pretty good. And just a reminder for those of you that are going to be listening to the second hour, Jake Brown will be on at 9 o'clock, and we hear he's going to have a stupendous rant about a certain manager named Terry Collins. So if you're listening to the show, make sure you tune in after the 9 o'clock hour.
That should be interesting.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Jake definitely gets into a little bit of a passion for his Mets. But we have our guest already on the line, and joining us this evening is a gentleman who wrote an absolutely fantastic book that we definitely think if you didn't get it for Father's Day, you got to go out and make sure you get it. It's a great summer read. It's called Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty, and the author's name is Charles Learson. He's joining us right now on Sports Talk 1240. Charles, this is Gary and John here on Sports Talk 1240 in Long Island. Good evening and happy Father's Day.
Oh, thanks so much. Happy to be here with you guys.
All right. Well, like I said, I was very excited to start reading this book, and I was one of the, I know among my friends I've talked to in the last couple of weeks, was very very intrigued by the movie that came out a decade and a half ago with, obviously, what Robert Wool and Tommy Lee Jones, and it gave a perspective, and I think most people, I think, you know, John and I are about the same age, you know, most things that we thought about with Ty Cobb, but tell us, first of all, about the inspiration of writing this book and some of the most, I guess, interesting things you picked up with on the research.
Well, my original inspiration was just to write a book about a great baseball player who hadn't been written about in a while. I mean, Cobb was, he's very well known, but his numbers are incredible. I mean, his batting average, .366. Highest in his day and still the highest ever all these years later. Some people say 367. You can get in a fight with some
mathematicians.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, right, over that. And so it just goes to show you how people have this guy on their mind that they'll fight over that one number. And when he retired, he had 90 records. I mean, he was an incredible ballplayer, but he hadn't been written about in about 20 years when I started out. And I was very much in the camp of, where most people were and maybe still are. I believe the myths as portrayed in that movie you mentioned and as, you know, as portrayed in a lot of articles and stuff on the Internet. And I thought I was just going to go out and write a book about, the worst monster in baseball, a guy who was a fantastic player but a horrible human being. And I mean, early on, one of the first things I did, I went to his grave in Royston, Georgia, and he's buried in this mausoleum, and you could look in through a window, and I saw his coffin in there, and I imagined this monstrous guy, you know, like they say your fingernails and your hair keep growing after you die, and I imagined this guy in this coffin, you know, and like Howard Hughes or something, and what I found out, though, when I got away from the cemetery and started to really do research, I found out that he was a very different man than he's been portrayed. I also found out, by the way, that your hair and your fingernails don't keep growing after you die.
Yeah, so go for that.
The things you've been hearing all your life, just because you've heard them a million times, that doesn't mean they're true. You got to go back to the facts, and you got to go back to the history.
And that's what I was really impressed about your book. It was a great read. I enjoyed it thoroughly. And also having been one of those people that heard so much about Ty Cobb and, you know, how much of this stuff got blown out of proportion and realistically mainly because of the Al Stump ghostwriter. It was supposed to be Ty Cobb's autobiography in 1961, which turned out to be a heck of a lot more fiction than fact.
Well, there were several things that this guy Al Stump wrote that were bad. The autobiography you mentioned was the first thing he did with Cobb, and that was like a standard as told to kind of autobiography, like we see from a lot of ball players. Pedro Martinez is one out now. That's kind of thing with a professional sports writer, and Stump played the role of the professional sports writer. The thing is that Cobb, while he was doing that book, was very sick and was dying, and Stump wouldn't let him see the manuscript. I found this out. This has never been revealed before. And then Cobb finally insisted and got to see the manuscript, and he flipped out because a lot of it was fiction, and a lot of it wasn't so bad, that first book about Cobb. But he tried to have it stopped just because it was all wrong. There were just factual errors, and there were errors of tone and attitude in it that just didn't represent the real Ty Cobb. But he died before he could stop its publication, and the big publisher Doubleday put it out anyway 2 months after he died. And then what Stump did was a couple of months after that, this is in 1961 when Cobb died, he wrote an article for a magazine called True Magazine, which completely distorted. He wrote about this drunken, crazy old man, that Cobb, waving a gun around. He beat up women. He tried to rape women. He was a horrible human being. And people were shocked by this, but they were also riveted and fascinated by it. You have to remember that article came out 9 years before the book Ball Four, Jim Boughton's book, which, right, you know, allegedly ripped the lid off, you know, what baseball players are really like. We never heard bad things about our baseball heroes, and this was the first time anything had been said. And Stump was a bad writer, but he was a great sensationalist, and he stumbled on this kind of fictional evil Cobb that people just were fascinated with, and they kept telling and retelling the stories, repeating them and embroidering on them. And then actually 30 years later, Stump wrote another book, which became the basis of that movie, in which he really stretched things out of proportion. And by then the racism myths had been added to the rumors and stuff. But you know, by then Stump was really had created an entire fictional character who happened to be named Ty Cobb.
Yeah, that's really what it was. It was just fiction. I mean, it was just amazing.
Another writer came along in the 80s, a guy named Charles Alexander, who I think was sincere and just made some mistakes. And what Alexander did was he misidentified some people as he said they were black that Cobb had fought with, very famous, had some fights with, because Cobb fought with a lot of people, and I don't make him out to be a saint in my book.
No, no.
But several of the key fights, Alexander says the men were black, and in fact they were white, so there was no racial issue involved. And people also assumed that because Ty Cobb was born in 1886 in Georgia, that he must be a racist.
Right.
That's the point I was just going to make, Charles, about that, because that really surprised me, you know, obviously being the makeup of that time. And as I was reading the first, I say 20% of the book, I was like, wow, you know, everything you kind of was led to believe as a kid, you know, the things that we read, you know, we grew up, John and I both grew up in the 60s and 70s. So, you know, those are the things you just thought were just, you know,
it's just fact.
It was complete fact. And I'm every page I'm reading, I'm going, Mike, God, I can't believe this. I can't believe the things that we were taught all these years are really not any truth to it at all.
Yeah, I mean, in some cases, it's the opposite of what we were told. And believe me, as I say, I started out in this other camp. I believed he was the monster. But when I came upon these documents and found out that he descended from a long line of abolitionists, his great-grandfather was a preacher who preached against slavery and got run out of town for it. His grandfather refused to fight in the Confederate Army because of the slavery issue, and his father was a state senator who spoke up for his black constituents and once broke up a lynch mob in town. And, you know, Cobb himself said nothing about race life until 1952, when someone asked him about the integration of the Texas League, and he said the Negro should be accepted into baseball wholeheartedly and not grudgingly. The Negro has the right to play professional baseball, and who's to say he has not?
Right. I mean, that, and that's what, you know, then I didn't, you just close your eyes and go back again to Al, to the movie, you know, like obviously based on Stump's book, and you look at some of the things that are going on, and you're going, you know, it just makes you, it makes you shake your head. But one thing I want to just get to and go back to the earlier part, again, there were a lot of misconceptions about what happened with Ty Cobb's father. You were talking about a state legislator, was an editor of a paper, I believe. He did a lot of educational stuff. But could you just explain to everybody the situation that went when Ty Cobb's father was apparently, I mean, was killed by his wife?
His wife, yeah, Cobb's mother, yeah. It, you know, the Cobb story in my book of the story is not just a refutation of the Al Stump thing. It's this fascinating tale of this man who invented himself and became like the first great baseball celebrity, and he had to overcome a lot. And the thing you mentioned is one of the main things. In 1905, in August, two and a half weeks before Ty Cobb came up to the major leagues for the Detroit Tigers, his mother shot and killed his father. Perhaps accidentally. I don't think we'll, as I say in the book, we'll never know for sure. I present a lot of the facts and kind of let the reader judge for himself what he thinks. But Cobb's father was an educator. He was going out making a trip to visit some schools. He left on a Tuesday, said he was coming back on Thursday. This is in a horse and buggy in 1905. But he came back that same night, not when he said he was coming back, and he was walking around on his own front yard late at night, and his wife heard the noise, grabbed a pistol, shot through the window, and killed him. Now, some people said there were rumors that she had been unfaithful to him, and he was coming back and checking on that. And others said that yes, that was true, and she knew very well he was in the yard doing that, and she knew very well who she was shooting. In any case, he was killed, and she was arrested and charged with first-degree manslaughter and had to stand trial. She was eventually acquitted. But you can imagine what it's like for Cobb. He's 18 years old when this happens. He's just coming up to the major leagues. The game he arrived for, he sat on the bench the very first game. He didn't get in, but that was the first major league game he ever saw, his first time north of the Mason-Dixon line. And he's in not great, you know, mental shape. That was late August when he came up, and then he finished out that season, only hit 240 in those couple of months, came back the next season, and then was subjected to a vicious hazing by
of
his teammates. Yeah, so he went through a lot. He overcame a lot. In fact, he had what we then call a nervous breakdown in 1906, the second half, between his mother being on trial, his father being shot, and the bullying and harassment. He had a nervous breakdown and was missing in action for 44 days. And you've read the book. You see how weird it is and how intriguing. I think that the sports writers didn't talk about it hardly at all, his absence even. And he was the hottest rookie by then in baseball. They didn't say he was gone, and when he came back 44 days later, they didn't say, "Oh, he's back."
Yeah, he's just back in the lineup. You know, there's no big deal about it.
Right. It was a shameful thing in those days to have a nervous breakdown. But Cobb was a very high-strung man, and as I say, he got in a lot of fights. He was not always easy to be around, and so that was part of who he was. You know, one of the things we have to remember was that there were no baseball heroes in 1905, really, when he came up. Baseball players were like treated like sort of circus performers or carnies. Yeah. They weren't revered the way they are now. And he was in the first wave, in the first generation. He and Christy Mathewson, probably, of the first superstars, the guys who got asked for their autograph and asked to do endorsements and things like that. So he was kind of cutting his own path through the forest, Ty Cobb was.
How do you go about researching, you know, because this is a guy who lived, you know, over 100 years ago. And, you know, as you indicated a few times throughout the book, there's no real videotape of him. There's few pictures of him. How do you go about finding out all these little facts and tidbits that you offer in the book?
Well, it's like any good detective work you do. It's a matter of, you know, going through a lot of, you know, using a lot of shoe leather, in the sense that you relentlessly pursue the coverage of the day, which the previous biographies, you know, it seems like a very logical thing. Well, go see what the sports writer said. Go see what was being said about him at the time he was playing. And by the way, at the time he was playing, he was not considered a monster. All that monster myth started in 1961 after he died. He was considered an intense player and a fierce player. And some said out-of-town sports writers, occasionally a dirty player because of the spikes thing, and we could talk about that in a minute. But the way you do it is first you go to the clips. There were a lot of there were more newspapers in those days than there are today, and baseball was covered very very thoroughly both by the Detroit papers and the out-of-town papers, and then I got private personal letters that had never been published before. And other historic documents, and, you know, about the trial of his mother and things like that. And you put it all together and you create a story.
Well, actually getting on to the on-field business of Ty Cobb, obviously we said the 367 average. And you know, those numbers are numbers that, you know, that are never going to be replaced, never going to ever be duplicated type things. But just going through some of his play, and again, obviously everybody that talks about Ty Cobb or reads the books knows about the fact of the spike situation, but I don't, again, there's things I've heard and maybe you can elaborate on it, but you know, I don't think he was looking to spike anybody, especially, I mean, I see one of the pictures I saw, he wasn't going for the spike, he was actually going for the baseball. He wasn't actually trying to hurt the player. He was trying to get the ball out of the catcher's hands.
Right, there's that famous picture I think you're referring to. He's airborne and he's coming in, and I say in the book the catcher is wincing like Lee Harvey Oswald in that famous picture, and it looks horrible, and it's often used to indict Cobb. But that catcher, it's very interesting. That catcher, his name is Paul Critchell. He wasn't a great baseball player, but he turned out to be a great scout. He was the scout who discovered Lou Gehrig a few decades later.
Wow.
And he later said, 40 years after that picture was taken, I found a quote from him saying, "Actually, it was my fault. I was in the way. I was standing in the base path, and Cobb had the right to dive into me." But Cobb never spiked him on that play. As you say, he knocked the baseball out of his hand cleanly, and the ball went all the way to the backstop. And they collided. It was a very violent encounter. And the two of them wound up rolling around and fighting, and I think they were both thrown out of the game by the umpire. But you know, I think that gets to my larger point I make in the book about Cobb, about what an exciting player he was. Who could not like a play like that where the base runner comes flying in, kicks the ball out of the catcher's hand, and, you know, and creates this mayhem, and that was the winning run in the game. You know, someone said that watching Babe Ruth hit a home run was not as exciting as watching Cobb get a walk, because when Ruth hit a home run, yeah, it was exciting, but it was over in a flash, and when Cobb got to first base, that's when the fun was just beginning.
Oh, yeah. Right, enticing the pitcher, stealing second,
right,
stealing third, and some even stealing home.
Yeah,
right.
54 times.
Still holds the record. You know, here's a guy who, like, he once stole second, third, and home and on three consecutive pitches. You know, he once got an inside-the-park home run on a tap back to the pitcher's box, and he didn't even slide when he scored. I mean, you know, the way that happened was the guy was a guy on third when he hit the grounder back to the pitcher, and the guy got caught in a rundown. Cobb came flying around. As soon as that guy got tagged out, he passed him, and he ran home. And the catcher, no one was covering home plate. They'd all been, you know, sidetracked by the guy, distracted by the guy who was in the rundown. So he did things like that all the time. And he was the other team's fans booed him sometime, and they loved to boo him. He was the worst news you could have, you know, for the other team. But he was also the biggest draw in baseball in his day, and we can't forget that. He was such an exciting player.
I mean, actually, the more and more I was reading through the numbers and reading through all your book, all I kept thinking about was, you know, you're trying to make comparisons to players either today or in the past. The one that, especially when you're talking about nonstop and everything, the one that keeps coming to mind, and it's another person who's been obviously vilified in baseball, and that's Pete Rose.
Right.
You know, in a sense, not exactly, but again, doing what needed to be done and putting the 120% into what he was doing. To me, that always described Pete Rose to me, and, you know, you hated the guy because, you know, being a Met fan and, you know, rooting against the Cincinnati Reds, you hated Pete Rose no matter what. But you know what? You had to appreciate what he was doing, because he was doing everything he could to get his team the advantage or get the lead or get the whatever. And that's exactly, as you're reading through your book, you find out that's what Ty Cobb was. I mean, yes, he was. He may have done things that probably not many people would have done, but he was doing whatever he needed to do to get that victory.
I think that comparison is very apt, yeah. But he was also, though, I think if he was different than Rose, he was more artistic than Rose. Rose was kind of this straight-ahead barrel in all the time. Cobb had 9 different kinds of slides. A lot of people don't appreciate this.
Mm-hmm.
And virtually all of them were all about giving the guy as little to tag as possible. You know, fadeaways and ways of going around the base. He was an artist of the slide, and he believed in actually avoiding contact as much as possible. You know, now having said that, if you were, he said, you know, in my little patch, he called it right in front of the base, then you know, that was your watch, as he said.
Right.
He did barrel into a lot of guys, but you know, I could not find a guy. It's chapter 17 of my book it discusses this, and it's one quote after the next, if you remember, of guys who were teammates, even teammates who didn't like him, like Wahoo Sam Crawford, mm-hmm. had to say Cobb never spiked anybody. You know, if you were sticking your hand in the wrong place, that was your fault. But he didn't go out of his way to spike people. One after the other, teammates, opponents, even umpires said that. And Cobb hated that reputation he had with some dumb sports writers, really, about being a dirty player. And he was so sick of it that in 1910 already, he was only in the major leagues 5 years, he wrote a letter to the American League president, Ban Johnson, that the Tigers released to the newspaper. So it was in the papers all over the country, where he asks Ban Johnson to make a rule that all the players had to file and dull their spikes.
That's right.
Right.
So, and then the umpire should inspect them before each game, you know, to avoid injury and accident, and also to avoid this rumor that he just couldn't shake. You know, I found that rumor about standing on the top of the dugout step and sharpening your spikes, that was like a folk tale that was applied to all kinds of players going back to the 1870s. It got said about Cobb, and it just got stuck with him. But as in the case with the racism, the opposite is true, if anything.
Well, and it's like, there were a lot of players in that era that were really larger than life, and it's like, and it's almost in a way, I was thinking, you know, to modern baseball, and occasionally you get the modern players who come up who are characters, and you know who you kind of remember for their antics, but it just seemed like Ty Cobb was the norm as far as these guys who were larger than life, and you know, baseball was finding its way at that you know, time in history. But he was far from the only guy who got into fights and, you know, things like that. So I think you also got to put that into context.
You do. You're exactly right. Baseball was evolving. As I say, it was brand new in 1901. The major leagues with American National League is only 4 years before Cobb came up, and the people were just learning how to act and what the etiquette was at a stadium and what the protocols were. There was only one umpire on the field in the early 1900s when Cobb first came up, and if fans didn't like his call, they didn't hesitate to jump over the wall and chase him around.
Yeah,
I
mean, they had, the police had to come in the riot. You know.
Right, the police would have to come out, and the other thing was, you know, ball players were constantly playing drunk. Alcohol was a huge problem. Not steroids, but alcohol, and you know, guys were vomiting on the field. I ran accounts of it. You know, the whole American League was invented and brought into being because the National League was thought was too rough and disgusting to bring your family to see. So Ban Johnson had this idea: let's start a league where we can bring families to the game. That didn't last too long because the players started to move back and forth between the leagues. Yeah, it was a very rough and tumble game, and Cobb, a lot of guys, you know, part of the deal was that they would, the infielders and the catchers would come down on the runners and with their spikes and jump on them. Cobb in 1958 showed a reporter from the Times his legs, and there were massive scar tissue, and he said, "I didn't get this from sliding down banisters. You know, this is the way the guys treated you," and that was all part of the game. You know, I found one catcher who said he whacked Cobb in the kidneys when he came into home plate, and Cobb passed out from it. And then, a couple of minutes later, he came to, dusted himself off, and went back to the dugout. You know,
he probably went out to right field the next inning. Right?
Right. That was the dead ball era for you. You know.
Well, you know, before we let you go, I just got to tell you, I had a It's funny. Reading your book one night, it was kind of late, and I ended up falling asleep, and I somehow was trying to dream if Ty Cobb was playing these days, and he had a Twitter account. What would you think, just as a joke, what would you think the thing that Ty Cobb would tweet the most?
I think I know it. That was a clean slide. I'm not a dirty slide. Does that exceed 140 characters?
Yeah, I think you're going to make it. Well, listen, Charles, we really thank you very much for coming on.
Awesome book, Charles.
Like
awesome
I said, we are telling everybody we know about it. And if you want to actually get in touch with Charles, you can actually go on his website, which is, as I'm clicking, charlesleerson.com. That's LEERHSEN.com. It's also at Charles Learson on Twitter. He's got a couple of other great books as well. I definitely suggest everybody go out and check it. Charles, again, we thank you so much for coming on tonight. We wish you the best with this book, and we'll definitely promote it every chance we can.
Thanks so much, guys. It was a lot of fun.
All right. Thank you. Take care. Have a great night.
You too.
All right. Thanks. That was Charles Learson talking about, again, Ty Cobb, A Terrible Beauty. You can get it on Amazon, at all local bookstores, iBooks especially with John being the Apple guy. We're going to take a couple-minute break. We're going to talk a little bit about some other things that have been going on. And hopefully around 8:40 or so, we're going to be speaking with Lou Ford, the player coach of the Long Island Ducks. So we'll take a couple-minute break. And this is Gary and John for Sports Talk 1240 WGBB.
And 1240 WGBB are proud to announce the new Sports Talk 1240, along with the launch of a brand new website at sportstalk1240.com. Check out our new site for information about upcoming shows, as well as easy access to past shows, articles, our live studio webcam, and more. Of course, be sure to tune in to Sports Talk 1240 every Sunday night from 8 to 10 p.m. on AM 1240 WGBB. Or visit sportstalk1240.com for ways to listen to the live broadcast online or from your iPhone. We're excited about these new changes and hope you will be too.
So you're looking for a great club but don't want to go into Manhattan, or you'd like to find a new restaurant to check out, or you're buying a house here on Long Island and you'd like to find out about a certain area. Wouldn't it be nice if you could find out all the information in just one spot? Well, you can. LongIslandExchange.com. It's all you need to find out all about Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com for hotspots, classifieds, news, and more. LongIslandExchange.com is designed with only the Long Islander in mind. Get the best of Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com. Discover Long Island all over again at LongIslandExchange.com.
If you're trying to quit smoking, dipping, or chewing tobacco, you don't have to do it alone. Nicotine Anonymous is a 12-step program of recovery that meets regularly in your area. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to be free of nicotine. For information and meetings near you, call 877-TRY-NIC-A. That's 877-TRY-NICA. Or visit nicotine-anonymous.org. Let us share our experience, strength, and hope with you.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240. Check us out every Sunday night at 8 p.m. right here on AM 1240 WGBB. And visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Making simple changes in your everyday travel choices makes a big difference to New York's air quality. Trip chain, use mass transit, rideshare, bike, or walk. Visit cleanairny.org to learn more. Clean Air New York, breathe it in. A public service message brought to you by the New York State Department of Transportation.
And now, back to Sports Talk 1240.
Hey, and we're back with the second half hour of Sports Talk 1240 tonight, proudly sponsored by Country Foot Care of Mineola and Williston Park. The doctors at Country Foot Care offer holistic, conservative treatment options backed by years of education experience. Your convenience, they carry a full line of products to enhance your customized treatment plan and or just to pamper your feet a little bit. You can contact them at www.countryfoodcare.com or call them at 516-741-FEET. They are also the proud sponsor of the Long Island Lizards lacrosse team, who unfortunately lost their first game of the season last night. I think they're 8-1. But doing great. If you love lacrosse, definitely go visit the guys over at the Long Island Lizards, New York Lizards. I always say Long Island Lizards. I say that accidentally. But so, John, we haven't talked to each other in a little while. We got to say congratulations to the Chicago Blackhawks on winning the Stanley Cup.
That was just an awesome series. If
you weren't a fan of hockey and you had to sit down for 20-odd hours over a week time and watch those six games, if you did not become a fan of hockey, there was something radically wrong with you.
Yeah, I mean.
It was outstanding. Goaltending was fantastic. Lots of great plays on both sides of the rink. I know a good buddy of mine, my friend Mike, who's been a diehard Chicago Blackhawk fan for 30 plus years. He unfortunately doesn't have the best ticker in the world, and it was almost giving him issues. Let's put it that way. But bottom line, he's a very happy man. He's getting insulted by a lot of Islander fans during the year, so he's kind of getting back at them. And in some cases, and I'm raising my hand, John, rightly so. But it was a great series, a great end to a season. That's what you want. No matter what, whoever would have played, whether it was the Rangers, whether it was the Lightning, whether it was the Blackhawks, whether it was the Ducks, whoever, as long as you get a Stanley Cup final, that's not a four-game series to me.
Yeah,
every game was one goal except for game six.
Right.
And even then, a couple of breaks here or there, and a game could have been tied or possibly going back to Tampa for game seven, and who knows what would have came out, if my buddy would even still be hanging around. I mean,
if it would have went to game seven.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Exactly. But, and of course now this week, the NHL draft, and, for us Islander folks that are listening to the show, just think, guys, this is the first time since 2007 that we do not have a pick in the first 15.
Yeah.
Our first pick, I think, is number, 90? In the third round. In the 70s.
Unless Garth does something that surprises us.
Rumor mill has it that a certain player, if you saw the article in Newsday today, that Kyle Poso could be a possible move. I don't think so.
I don't see that happening.
I don't. Again, knowing Garth the way I do, and talking to him indirectly, and of course, with our booster club, we had a meeting with him in May, and people were kind of, asking on that. And of course, Garth never puts his cards on the table. And one thing he's learned over his 10 years is he doesn't do that, and he's very smart at that. But you could tell by the inflection, you can tell by the sound of his voice that he is thrilled as can be with the guys he's got that are heading to Brooklyn in October. And all it's going to take maybe is a tweak or two here or there. Obviously, there are guys that need to be signed, potentially, that may not be signed. You look at guys that maybe have 1 year left on their contract case in point, Michael Grabner. He's owed $5 million this year, only three on the cap.
Right.
But you think anybody's going to take him? I mean, to be fair, as a hockey fan, you think anybody's really going to say, I want Michael Grabner on my team?
Yeah, especially over the last couple of seasons with the injuries and...
Especially when you rely on your legs to have groin injuries the way he does.
Sports hernia surgery again.
He needs to have the summer of his conditioning life to prove people wrong. And unfortunately, his entire career, basically, from junior hockey to the AHL to the NHL, has been to prove people wrong. And he's done it everywhere he's been. And I think he's going to have to do it again.
Yeah.
I mean, what do the Islanders need, obviously? You need to see if they're going to get a backup goaltender, if Neuvirth is going to be given the chance to be the full-time number two. It's a possibility. A lot of fans didn't like him ever since he came over. I mean, he had an incredible last month in Buffalo. His numbers were off the charts. But,
it didn't quite live up to expectations.
It didn't live up. And, of course, the typical argument we still hear on Islander boards almost two months after they're out of the playoffs is, is Josh Bailey still going to be here?
No, come on.
I mean,
leave
give me
Josh
a break.
Alone.
Exactly. Leave him alone. He's improved every year he's been here. So, give him a break.
It's no coincidence that when they put him on the top line with Tavares' season turned around.
Exactly. Well, listen, we got our second guest on the line. And for you folks on Long Island, if you have not been to Bethpage Ballpark lately, why not? All right, come on. You've got a great baseball team, and the Long Island Ducks just won their 19th game in the last 20. They're unbelievably white hot, and Their star outfielder and bench coach, Lou Ford, is joining us. Lou, this is Gary and John on Sports Talk 1240. Good evening, and how are you this evening? And happy Father's Day.
Thank you, guys. Doing good. How are you?
All right, great. All right. Again, white hot, 19 out of 20. What do you make of it? I mean, have you ever had a streak like that in any part of your professional career?
I can't remember anything like that happening. You know, baseball is a game where, you know, you can't expect to be winning every night. I mean, it's very difficult to do. So to do what we're doing is it's pretty amazing. And, you know, a lot of things have been going our way, but we got a really good team.
You definitely do. And the thing that I think has been most impressive to me watching you guys, and I've been watching some of the games on the internet from afar, is that you're doing it in every possible way. I mean, one night you're bouncing 18 hits and getting 10 runs. The next night your pitching is fantastic. You're getting contributions from just about every player on the team. I mean, I know the last two games, Dan Lyons, your shortstop, who's not known for having the home run trot, had two straight games with home runs. I mean, you know, have they been giving him something extra in his breakfast in the morning?
Yeah, we've been giving Dan a little slack on that. He's looking a little bigger and starting to hit the ball over the fence. He's not really known for those home runs, but he's having an amazing year this year. You know, he's hitting really well and been clutch for us, and you know, he's doing the job. And he's always been really good on defense, so that's been pretty steady for us too.
Well, for the fans who or people who may not be familiar with the Ducks lineup, give us a rundown as to like who's really the people, because I'm going to be going out there soon. Who are the guys I should be paying attention to? Who's really the quote unquote stars, or who's getting the job done?
Other than yourself.
Yeah, other than yourself.
I mean, it's tough to leave anybody out because, you know, everybody's making a contribution. We have a local guy out near Riverhead, Brian Sabatella. He's leading off and doing well, and picked up a guy, Delta Cleary, a switch hitting outfielder. He's second, I'm third, and Randy Ruiz, an ex big league guy, mm-hmm. big power hitter. He's cleaning up there, and you got a first year guy, John Griffin, playing first base, and he's batting fifth. He's got, you know, a bunch of home runs this year. Big kid, and Dan's been hitting nine, I think, for a few years, and he's comfortable there, and he's really really tearing it up. But you know, any given night, it's everybody's making the contribution, you know, offensively, and the pitching staff's been really good too. You have to have it all to, you know, win 19 out of 20.
Well, one thing I definitely noticed, especially if if anybody listening goes on the Long Island Ducks website and looks at their roster, if you guys really don't, you know, if you finish the season and win the championship, you guys can go out in October and November and field a heck of a basketball team. Man, between Barbosa at 6'8", Sabatella 6'5", Griffin 6'6".
Some big boys.
You know, I know you could be the point guard at 6 foot, but I mean, but come on.
Yeah, that's
This has got to be one of the biggest lineups I've ever seen. I mean, every pitcher on your roster is at least 6'1". I mean, they're huge.
Yeah, we got some big boys. You know, if I think the other team might think twice about, you know, charging the mound or starting something with that team. It's all these big guys coming out there at them. You know, even some of the coaches are big guys too. With Marty Jansen, the pitching coach, he's a pretty big guy too.
Yeah, he is. He is a big boy.
So I don't think the other team's going to be starting too much trouble with us. We got some big guys over here.
Now, right now the Ducks are sitting at 38-17, a game and a half behind the Somerset Patriots. I believe it's only another 2 weeks left in the first half.
That's right.
Yeah. So I mean, obviously 19-20. Do you guys have any games left with Somerset before the end of the half?
Yeah, we do. That's going to be a good one to come out to. We're actually the last three games of the first half. We're going to play them three games here with Somerset here in Long Island.
Oh, that's brilliant.
It's probably going to come down to that.
Oh, yeah.
Which is nice. I mean, that's how you want it. So we're kind of looking forward to that series.
Well, how about, you know, just to take the focus a little bit off the Ducks, for people who are not familiar with you personally, how about some background about, because, you know, you've had obviously, you know, major league experience and stuff. Tell people about, you know, who you are and how you got to be on the Ducks.
How I got to be here, I was 2009 was my first year here. I went to spring training with Colorado, and I got released for the first time in my career, and had a friend that ended up being here on the Ducks, and he gave me a call and, you know, told me about the league. I really didn't know much about it at the time. You know, I'd heard a little bit, you know, because I guess when they started, they had, you know, Ricky Henderson and a lot of big name guys. I'd heard a little bit, but, you know, I didn't know much about it at all. And, you know, it's good baseball. That's the first thing I noticed when I got here. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, there were a lot of ex-big league guys there, guys that really good players. And, you know, you got to, you know, you'll be on top of your game to do well in this league. And, you know, it's from there, it was, I got picked up a few times, but 2012 was the year, you know, I had a big year where I got signed out of here with Long Island, picked up by the Orioles, you know, made it back to the major leagues that year with them. And, you know, that would have never happened, you know, if not for this league and the Ducks. You know, it's, gave me a chance to continue my career. And, I really think a lot of what this league does for the guys that, you know, there's no spot for him, maybe an affiliated at that moment, but, you know, they want to keep playing and chase that dream. You know, this is the spot to be.
And especially in this league, again, you know, we've been, you know, John and I have been going to games for years, and we always find out that, at least in the Atlantic League, comparative to some of the other independent leagues, that it seems like, and especially with Long Island, it's the type of organization that really seems to care about the players so much that they, you know, of course they'd love to see them play the rest of the year, but if they've got the opportunity, if they get the chance to get that major league or even that double A or triple A, you know, chance to go back to the show, the organization seems to do whatever they can do for them. And I know you've had to feel that exact same way. So I would think it's a loyalty factor, you know, after you left Baltimore, to obviously to come back to Long Island and get the opportunity, as you've been doing this season and last season, get your feet into the coaching aspect of the game.
Yeah, I'm really grateful to, you know, get that chance here to be the hitting coach. And, you know, I tell some of the guys that we bring in, you know, are friends of mine or ex-teammates. And, you know, I got to explain to them kind of what you were saying. This is, you know, the chance to, you know, get back and, you know, get back on top of your game and, you know, hopefully make it back to the major leagues or wherever, you know, get back into affiliated. And, you know, that's the goal for a lot of these guys. So, you know, it's a high level of play, you know, when everybody's, you know, trying to get that call or that spot, you know, so it's pretty good competition.
How difficult is it, though, you know, being in this type of situation where you do have guys who might be coming in and out of the lineup? You don't really even know who's going to last the whole season because they might get the opportunity to play with a major league team or whatever. How difficult is that to really field the team and keep everybody on an even keel?
Yeah, it is difficult. We have a great GM here, Mike Pfaff, and, you know, he's always on top of, you know, everybody that's released, and you always got to be one step ahead, you know, because you never know when you're going to lose your best player. You know, unfortunately, that's what happens. You know, the guy that's picked up is your, you know, probably your best player, best pitcher, or best hitter. So you've got to, you know, always be ready to, you know, have some guys that you know, looking at and want to bring in. And I'm getting a chance to, you know, be a part of that now, being in the coaching side, and you know, I enjoy, you know, trying to get guys here. You know, that's kind of part of the job when you're a coach. So.
And being involved in the decision-making. Now, yes. Now next week, actually starting after Monday's game against Bridgeport, you guys got to get on a plane and to all places. You know, again, for people who haven't been out to the Ducks games lately, there is a team in, of all places, Sugar Land, Texas.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, having to now, what is it like to deal with, especially, you know, you go on the road, that's one thing. And again, being a former major league ball player, you've been on the road, you've done those 10-game road swings and all that other stuff. But, and you've done, obviously, now the road, having to be on the buses going back and forth between Camden and Somerset and what have you. But to get on a plane and deal with a 6-game series. I can understand if you have, you know, if you have like two rainouts in April or whatever, and you got to play five games or whatever. But you have six games scheduled in 6 nights. What the heck is that like for these guys? I mean, first of all, you have to get on the plane is one thing, but then to stay in that lovely hotbed of southeast Texas for a week.
Right. Where, you know, the weather up here is beautiful. I think it was 75 or 80 today. You get down there, you know, you're looking at 95 with some, you know, right on the coast, so you're serious humidity.
And of course they're called, they're called the Skeeters, so you have to deal with that thing too, the mascot.
Skeeters, and they have a lot of those down there too.
Yeah,
it's everybody's got to do it for one thing, and I'd hate to be on the Skeeters and having to, you know, make that trip. You know, every time they go on the road, they're gonna, you know, I think we got a 4 o'clock bus, you know, to try to catch that airplane. So, you know, they're doing that every time they go on the road.
Right.
But yeah, they got
true.
A beautiful stadium down there, a beautiful city. So, you know, they got a lot of good things happening. It's just the travel's really tough for that one.
Well, I mean, the where you guys play isn't too shabby. I mean, it's a great ballpark, and it's a great experience that for anybody who's not got out to see the Ducks play. It's so family friendly. I mean, do you guys like pick up on this stuff and you know, you're basically filling the ballpark. I mean, is it like in the pros? I mean, do the players pick up on this and kind of feed off of that?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's not very exciting playing in an empty stadium, you know.
Right.
So, you know, in our place, you know, I feel like we got the best fans here in Long Island in this league, and you know, they're always there till the end, and you know, always cheering us on. It's a great atmosphere there. I mean, we had Father's Day today. They got, you know, father and son get to go on the field before the game and have a catch, and it's very family oriented, and you know, I like that. You know, I like it a lot.
What have you what thing, I guess, about Long Island, you know, obviously you came here, you know, obviously to Citi Field and Yankee Stadium during your times playing, has there been anything about Long Island that's kind of surprised you?
Yeah, I'd say a lot of things. I mean, I'm from Texas, so you know, you have maybe some stereotypes in New York, but you know, everybody's, you know, it's until you get up here and hey, this isn't New York City, this is Long Island, and you know, it's the weather's great in the summer, you got the beaches, you know, it's not tall buildings, you know, you got, you know, nice communities that you know, very community oriented, and I'm making my home here now, so I like it. I like living up here.
What has been so far, you know, being with the Ducks? What's really been like your, I guess you'd say, your fondest memory as being either, you know, being a coach or being a player so far?
Well, I mean, it's got to be the winning the championship. You know, that's something you never forget, and you know, always remember the guys that you know you fought with and, you know, battled with to win that thing. And, you know, I was here in 2013 for that championship at the end. And, mm-hmm. you know, we weren't expected to win that year. And, you know, we just outplayed them. We took it to them at Somerset. It was Somerset that year. And,
yep.
You know, I remember, Ray Navarette had a big home run there in the last game. And, you know, that's something, you know, I'll never forget, and I'm sure all the other guys we played with, you know, we'll always have that memory together, that championship season.
Absolutely. I'm sure, you know, ending your career, you know, winning a championship, I'm sure for Ray was probably, you know, a dream come true. Now I just realized that you said you're from Texas. You're only about, about an hour and a half drive from your home?
Yeah, in Sugar Land. I grew up down there, but it's not the best place to be playing baseball in the summer.
No, I totally agree. I got family in, I thought Dallas was bad, but Houston, yeah. Believe me, is even more tougher to deal with in the summertime.
Yeah. So I'm going to have a lot of family and friends down there, and you know, a week is that's good enough for me. You know, I go down there for a week and then get out of there. So. But it'll be good to go down and see family and friends and, you know, catch up a little bit down there.
That's you know, that's always fun to catch up with the family and the friends. I mean, is it from a player's standpoint? I mean, how different is playing in the Atlantic League? I mean, there's obvious differences. I mean, I'm not talking about the obvious differences between that and the major leagues, but I mean, what types of differences from the player's perspective could you can you know that come to mind?
From differences from
Being in the major leagues, traveling with teams and so forth, and just the routine and you know and stuff like that, or is it much different?
The major leagues is it's a whole different animal. I mean, you're under the microscope. There's a lot of pressure there's a lot of great things in the major leagues as far as like the fans, the travel, the way you're treated, everywhere you go is, like you're kind of like royalty or something. It's crazy. And, that part, I don't know how to explain it exactly. I guess, just the fact that you're on TV every night and, in the paper and all those kind of things, that's a lot lower scale here, but I mean the game is the game.
Yeah, I mean
game on the field.
Yeah, I mean just like the routine stuff, the preparation. Is it any different than the level of preparedness and the types of things that players do.
Yeah, I mean it's not that much different. You try to bring your preparation. Having the experience I do and trying to help out the younger guys here with theirs and get them on a good routine, especially when I was the hitting coach, trying to get the guys on a good routine with the hitting and, not too much or not too little. And, it's pretty similar. Some guys, a little younger, maybe, they need to work on a few things, the major leagues is kind of, hey, you're expected to perform. If you need to do it, you better. If you need to work on something, you better do it on your own, kind of thing. It's up to you.
So, last question before we let you go, Lou. Obviously, you were the hitting coach. You've now I don't want to say graduated, but moved up to the bench coach. What's the differences now in being in that position? Is it more of an advisory position with Kevin Baez? I mean, are you kind of getting more into the planning stages of, what the lineups are going to be, what different things you're going to do? What's the differences between your job as hitting coach, obviously, is working with the guys, but what is the job basically of the bench coach?
Well, I've been pretty much doing the same thing this entire season. I'm getting a lot more, they're coming to me. I guess I'm talking a lot more feedback, on the pitchers, the hitters, the lineup, just talking with Kevin and, if he's asking me, what I think about this that those kind of things, that's, I guess, more what the bench coach does, and the hitting coach is, you're just specifically, help those guys out with the hitting. But, I've been a lot more involved this year with the entire aspect of the game. And I like it. I'm, looking forward to, keep doing more, whatever they need me to do there. But I'm enjoying myself there, and we're having a really good year, so. It's going well.
Well, listen, Lou, we thank you for taking a few minutes on your Father's Day to come join us tonight again. Keep up the great work on the streak.
Definitely.
I know we're going to be both coming over to see a couple of games in July. I'm going to try to actually get to that series with Somerset. I definitely want to work a couple of games. So hopefully we'll catch you up at that point.
That sounds great. That's going to be a good series.
Yep.
Anybody out there, that'd be a good one to go to.
Definitely.
All right, again, Lou, thank you very much for coming on, and enjoy the rest of your weekend.
All right. Thank you.
All right, take care. All right. That was Lou Ford of the Long Island Ducks. Again, the team is white hot. If you're not going to the games, please do.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a great experience. It's certainly a lot more affordable than going out to Yankee Stadium or Citi Field.
And, you know, we got 2 minutes, and Jake Brown's coming on in the 9 o'clock hour. And, you know, Jake is a huge Met fan. I mean, he's about ready to have his rant in a few minutes. Jake, if you're listening, maybe you may want to go to the Ducks games a little cheaper. They're winning. They've won 19 of 20, Jake, okay? You don't have to get into, like, a cardiac infarction here, you know, watching your team. And, again, we're Met fans, too, so, you know, believe me, we know your pain. But this was fun. We haven't been here in about 5-6 weeks, so, you know, it was nice to get back on the microphone again.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, actually, in July, I'm going to see if I can get my sponsor, Mr. Dr. Stephen Brook, to come on the show again and talk about Mets.
You know, good the last time.
Yeah, we had fun with him.
He had a lot of insight. He was really...
He's more than just bunions and foot surgery. I'm telling you that. But like I said, if you want to contact us, I am at G Harding WGBB on Twitter. John is at Hockey Blindside. We will probably be on again in about 4 weeks. Check out sportstalk1240.com. On the left side of the screen, there's a schedule, and I'll let you know when we're back on again. We should be on in about a month, and you know, that'll be our 2-year anniversary that we're on WGBB.
It's crazy.
I can't believe Rob's kept us on here this long. What is he thinking?
Yeah, hasn't figured it out yet.
No, he hasn't figured it out yet. But, John, it was great as usual.
Yes, definitely. Thank
and
you.
Always, Brian does a great job behind the glass. He is the man of the hour.
It definitely.
He is the man of the hour. We can't do anything without him. You know, but, again, make sure you tune in the second half hour. Jake Brown is actually right now pacing the hallway here in front of the studio, getting ready to rant and rave. And John and I are going to sit here and listen to this first 5 minutes because I want to see what he's got to say. It's going to be fun. So, again, have a great week. Have a great rest beginning of the summer and July 4th weekend. In the words of my good friend Bill, the late Bill Hayes, keep skating, everybody. And we'll talk to you next month on Sports Talk 1240 WGBB.
Views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.